Members, we've got three items on our agenda today. First, the Legislative Coordinating Commission, the LCC Benefit Book. Mr. Hubinger is here from the LCC, so we'll have him come and present that to us for our approval.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission, here to talk about the 2014 Benefit Book, or as it's more affectionately known, the Legislative Plan for Employee Benefits and Policies. This plan establishes terms and conditions of employment for House, Senate, and joint legislative staff. It also establishes insurance benefits for both staff and members of the legislature. This plan was approved by the LCC last month. The insurance and vacation and sick leave provisions are within the jurisdiction of the LCC, so they are now in effect. Other provisions of the benefit book do not go into effect until they're approved by the respective Senate and House Rules Committees. These proposed changes were put together by a staff group from the Senate and the House and the joint offices. We met last fall and reviewed proposed changes to the state collective bargaining agreements and our other institutional needs and proposed these changes by consensus. A list of those names is included at the end of the summary that I provided to you. I've divided the summary into two sections, those provisions that are within the jurisdiction of the LCC and then those that are within the jurisdiction of the two rules committees. The substantive changes are fairly limited. The first section relates to sick leave use. There was a statutory change in 2011 that we incorporate here that relates to the use of sick leave by employees to care for their adult children, for siblings, and for their grandparents. The other set of substantive changes reflects the changes to the state employee group insurance program. The LCC for many years has provided insurance for the legislature by participating in the state employee group insurance program. That program is negotiated by the state employee unions and Minnesota Management and Budget and incorporated into those contracts. Those contracts have been given interim approval by the LCC Subcommittee on Employee Relations. There weren't any major changes to that insurance program. The two significant ones relate to the premiums. Beginning in January of 2015, employees will begin paying 5% of the premium for employee-only coverage. The current provisions providing for the state to pick up 15% of the cost for dependent coverage continues. The other change in the insurance program relates to the maximum reimbursements for dental coverage that increased from the previous level of $1,000 to $1,500 per year beginning in 2014. Those are the significant items in the portions of the book that are under the jurisdiction of the LCC. Other provisions are, as I said before, under the are only effective when adopted by the Rules Committee. Most of these changes are quite technical in nature. The one substantive change is on page 3 of the summary relating to expense reimbursements for staff. This is for staff of the legislature who travel on legislative business and relates to the reimbursements that they can receive for meals. These amounts were increased this year for the first time in 15 years, I believe, and reflect the changes that were negotiated in the state employee contracts. The per meal increase varied between $1 and $3 per meal. There are a couple of sections in the Senate version of the benefit book that are different from the LCC's. These differences continue unchanged. They relate to the eligibility for service awards for Senate employees and the amount that the Senate contributes for deferred compensation. That match continues unchanged at $750 per year. Mr. Chair, that's a quick run through of the changes. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hubinger. Any questions?
This is Alka the Ranger. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification, how much is the meal reimbursement now? I know you said $1 or $2, but what is it going to?
Age 61.
What is it?
Age 61.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, that's on page 61 of the benefit book. There are two different sets of amounts, one for travel within the state of Minnesota and for travel outside. Within the state, breakfast increases from $7 to $9, lunch from $9 to $11, dinner from $15 to $16. And outside the state adds $3 to each meal.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Hahn, you're on the LCC. Would you like to make the motion?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I would move we adopt the report.
Senator Hahn moves adoption of the LCC benefit book presented to the committee by Mr. Hubinger. Any other questions? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Comment.
Senator Sabin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to tell the whole Rules Committee that one discussion that took place in the LCC that I appreciated was that there was a discussion over whether to extend paternal leave benefits for employees of the legislature, and it was agreed that there would be a small group of people who would look at extending that benefit, and I look forward to that discussion, and hopefully that can be brought forward in a recommendation in the future.
Thank you, Senator Sieben. Ms. Zoff, winter weather emergency policy.
Mr. Chairman, members, you have before you a document that had been reviewed by the members of the Management Advisory Committee in response to the recognition that it would be useful for employees to have a good sense of when the Senate may take action to actually shut down because of severe weather and what the consequences would be if that decision was made with respect to their pay. I would point out that since the MAC reviewed this, at that time we were looking at a document that was captioned Winter Weather Emergency Policy, and we decided it would be more appropriate to change that to Severe Weather in case there was some other kind of episode that took place in the summer that required the same kind of response. The mechanism that we would use to declare a weather emergency for the Senate would be that the Secretary of Senate would confer with the Majority Leader and the Minority Leader or their designees and decide whether the conditions warranted closing the Senate down because of the weather and the difficulty or danger to employees in getting into work. And if it was determined that the Senate should close down for the day, we would declare a weather emergency. And I've been working with the director of CIS and the Public Information Office to come up with a reasonable way of notifying members and staff as to this condition. And once the Rules Committee has adopted a policy on this subject, I will send an email to all senators and staff informing you of where you will be looking to be informed of this policy. And at this point, we're looking at putting something on the Senate website, changing the voice message that would be accessed if you called into the Senate Public Information line, and possibly notifying people on a Twitter or some other kind of a message that would be sent to their devices. So that will be concluded by the end of this week, so people will have a sense, assuming that you adopt this, of what to look for in terms of notification. The upshot of the adoption of this policy would be to clarify that if the Senate is closed because of a weather emergency, for those staff who are regularly scheduled to work that day or that part of the day, say if you were sent home because of bad weather situation, that if you left or did not come to work because of the weather emergency, you would still be paid for that day or that part of that day.
Ms. Zoff, I can remember times when we sent Senate employees home early, and I believe we paid them for the day. Can you ever remember a time where the Senate was totally closed for a day?
Mr. Chair, members, I don't recall a day when there was a complete shutdown of the Senate that was officially a weather emergency. We didn't have a policy like this in place, but in talking to some of the other long-term staff, we've all remembered some occasions when there were, you know, days that made it virtually impossible for people to get in. I was told that there was one session day when the Secretary of the Senate and the Majority Leader and perhaps a couple of other senators and a couple of other people from the Senate desk made it into the Senate and convened the Senate because it was scheduled to convene that day and then adjourned. So there have been a couple of days when it was virtually impossible for people to get in, and certainly we would expect employees, even if we didn't declare an emergency, to use their best judgment about coming in or not. But this provides a mechanism for recognizing the pay consequences.
I think what's important, members, is we don't currently have a policy in the Senate, so... I mean, and I was contacted by multiple people whether the Senate was going to be open the day that the governor closed the schools, and we had no mechanism by which to do this. So we thought coming up with some kind of a policy that involved both caucus leaders and the Secretary of the Senate would be probably the appropriate thing to do. So that's why you see this in front of you today. And this is really kind of is similar to what I believe MMB has for all of their employees in administration. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions. First one for you, if you know. Would this policy in any way affect the mandatory legislative days? Is it going to cause us any kind of a problem because we are required to meet on certain days?
Well, that's constitutional, so I don't know that we can pass any kind of a provision that can override the Constitution. I do think, as Ms. Zoff provided, I mean, when we adjourn until a time certain, we actually have to come back at that time. We can't just waive that. So somebody will have to be here to gavel the Senate in, even if our employees are not here, because when we adjourn to a time certain. So I think that's my best answer. Mr. Bonner?
Mr. Chairman, if Senator Newman is asking about a minimum number of days, the Constitution certainly doesn't require that. The one day would be sufficient, I think, to satisfy the requirements of the Constitution. But as the chairman points out, a quorum is not necessary to adjourn the Senate. And if there is a scheduled daily session of the Senate on a particular day, basically I think two members could accomplish that task.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Potter. What I was really thinking about is if we declare a Senate emergency due to weather, employees don't have to come in, and we are due to have session that day, and Secretary of the Senate doesn't come in, or the other staff don't come in, the floor staff, we are required to meet. Now, I assume the senators are not being affected by this policy. What do we do?
That's correct, Senator Newman. This does not affect members of the Senate. Any senator can gavel in the Senate, even you, Senator Newman, and maybe Senator Pappas will give you an opportunity to do that, but do we need staff?
Mr. Chairman, in the unlikely event no staff were able to make it into the building, I think, again, two senators could accomplish convening and adjourning the Senate for the purpose of those requirements.
And if I may, one question for Ms. Zoff, if I may, Mr. Ms. Zoff, you indicated that this policy is going to be in effect for Senate employees who don't come to work due to the weather-related problem. How do you, as a Secretary of or a Secretary of the Senate, make that determination whether folks didn't come because of the weather-related issue or some other reason? If it's for some other reason, I would assume they would not then be paid. How do you make that determination?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, there is a provision in here, and this is consistent with the state policy for the executive branch, that if an employee had been scheduled to be out for a vacation, for example, they would not be compensated under this policy, that this is intended to apply to those who do not come to work because of the weather. And, I think we would have to rely on the veracity of the employees to, appropriately declare what their situation was. But if someone was out, they were out of town, they were on a vacation, they would not be eligible for the payment that's provided here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
I wasn't going to make much of a comment, Mr. Chair, but are we just getting soft? You know, since Pioneer days, we haven't had any policy dealing with weather at the state capitol. I would imagine the Ranger delegation wouldn't have a problem with a mere 30 below temperature. I'm sure they would be able to get here. So I'm kind of wondering, even as kids, I can't remember us ever closing schools down based on, maybe on snowfall because you couldn't get any buses down the road, but temperature-wise, I don't think we ever closed anything. And so I'm sure it's all that global warming that's coming in that's affecting our policies, but somehow we seem to be getting kind of soft. And I would hate to have our reputation tarnished anymore.
Senator Limmer, was that a question?
Yeah.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a comment and a question, but I was thinking along the same lines. I mean, graduating from Virginia, Minnesota, I'm thinking it was so cold every day in the winter. It was so cold. But Senator Bach, I know you're from the same area. It's like nothing stops you, and it makes you tougher and, I think, better. But I do have a question for Ms. Soff, clarification. So if we'd had a scenario where the governor closes the schools because of cold weather, we still have the option to remain open, or does it automatically apply? And the reason why I say that is I think part of it was they didn't want kids out by the buses and all that. But I think we're all adults, so we can get here. And so I want to make sure that that's still an opportunity.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, that's absolutely right. And I don't think this does imply that we're getting soft, because I would anticipate it's very unlikely this is going to be used. I mean, this doesn't make it any more likely that we're going to close the Senate. I think it just provides a means of notifying people whether or not this is going to occur, and also describes what the consequences would be. But, Senator Gazelka, just to be very clear, any action that the governor takes with respect to either the students or with respect to state employees doesn't have any bearing on whether or not when the Senate decides to close. That's going to be the decision of the leaders.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Soft, so in the past, is this mostly to relate to closing the building before people leave in the morning? Because we've closed it before on a Friday afternoon when a storm is coming and it looks like the roads are going to be really bad, and so we've closed the building and sent everyone home. I remember that happening.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, this policy is broad enough that it would apply to either circumstance. Certainly, it's a lot easier to notify employees if the Senate is going to be closed. If it's during the workday, information can get out to the employees without much difficulty. And so this clarifies what the process is going to be in either circumstance.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I really haven't been going around the table talking about how tough we are. I mean, we should all bring pictures from when we were little kids to show how tough we were. Although, to be fair, not me. I hate the winters here. But haven't we closed the building in the last several years because of
snow?
Pardon me?
I just said that.
Yeah, but I mean, were we not before people came in?
Right. Where, in the afternoon. Right.
And we said we weren't going to be in session the next day. The building was closed down. So that belies all this talk about how tough we are. We did it in, 4 years ago, 3 years ago?
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chairman, despite Senator Limmer, we're not that tough.
Well, Mr. Chair,
I do think we need a formal policy. I mean, it's very easy for the two caucus leaders to notify their partisan caucus staff. It's more difficult for all of the other members of the Senate, all the nonpartisan staff, to know. So I don't anticipate ever executing this, I hope. But I do think we all should have some kind of a procedure in place in the event that we need to for something totally unforeseen to us today. Senator Hammond.
Mr. Chairman, just this provision that requires majority minority leader or their designees, do we need to specify a designee? You know, is that something that would be need to be done in advance so that, or how what do you anticipate? Maybe Ms. Off can answer that. So I'd like to specify Senator Fischbach to be my designee. Do I need to have that in the statute? Or, I mean,
I'm
in the,
so honored.
I think it's Senator Gazelka, because I don't know if he's ever going to agree.
Maybe Limerick could prove his toughness if
right.
he
Mr. Chair, I'm the only one that didn't have to talk about how tough I am, so that just proves how tough I am.
But is maybe Ms. Ofkin, do we need to have somebody designated, or what's the...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, it would be good for you and Senator Bach to each designate a designee. And to be honest, I believe when we were talking about this in the management group, the assumption was that it would probably be the chief of staff for each caucus, because they would be... Typically, they would be here, and they'd be able to be reached. So, but I think it is useful for each of you to tell me who your designee is for this purpose.
The weather czar.
Any other questions on the 2.47 severe weather emergency policy? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Ms. Zoff.
I think you did.
Mr. Chairman, who moved that motion?
It was Senator Pappas, wasn't it?
Was it you, Senator Pappas?
I think it was me.
Senator Pappas moved it.
Good job.
Very observant. Yeah. Came ready for work today. Next, members, the Legislative Office Facilities Project Review. Wayne Waslowski's here, but maybe before we have Mr. Waslowski from admin talk, maybe we can ask Mr. Bodern to explain to us why this issue is in front of the Rules Committee when the building was already passed in law.
Mr. Chairman and members, the omnibus tax bill contained the provisions that provide the lease purchase authority for the legislative office building, and let's see, Article 12, Section 21 contains paragraph E, which requires the Commissioner of Administration to submit the program plan and cost estimates for all elements necessary to complete the project to the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration for its approval before the Commissioner can proceed with preparing final plans and specifications. I will add the note that the term program plan and cost estimates is used elsewhere in law and has a common understanding through years of use. It's contained in Section 16B335, which requires the commissioner to submit the program plan and cost estimates for almost all construction and major remodeling to legislative chairs. In that instance, it's used as a notice requirement and not as an approval requirement. But again, that is a term that has a common understanding through its application in Section 16B335. So the document that is attached to the admin letterhead is the program plan and cost estimates as submitted by the commissioner to the Rules Committee for its approval.
Mr. Waslowski, welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, my name is Wayne Waslowski. I'm the Senior Director for Real Estate and Construction Services within the Department of Administration. I also have with me Darren Knapp with Mortenson and Catherine Leonidas with BWBR. Together, Mortenson and BWBR have joined to form the design-build team on the project. Today, what we'd like to do is just walk through a brief overview of the design information that was submitted, I believe, distributed to the members of the committee, as well as discuss the project budget and cost benchmarking that we've completed, and then do a brief discussion of the schedule, and then stand for any questions that you may have, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
Sure.
As far as how to proceed. With that, I'll turn it over to Catherine Leonidas to walk through, and maybe if we could just hold up the,
sure.
It's the design information that was all the members should have.
Members, and that is in your packets.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I would like to just walk actually through a couple of things related to these projects, and I'm going to flip through this material and make selected comments as I go along.
Ms. Leonidas, maybe we should have your name and
certainly.
Who you represent.
Catherine Leonidas with BWBR Architects.
Thank you.
Thank you. On page 2 of the material that we submitted is a site plan that shows you the respective lots, Lot B and Lot C. Lot B is directly north of the Capitol, and that contains both the legislative office building and about 265 below-grade parking stalls. Lot C is an independent, standalone parking facility that is above grade and that is bounded by Sherburn and Rice Street. As I turn to page 3, just to give you an orientation then of the legislative office building, it is bounded by Sherburn Park, University Avenue. The building is set back on the site, and there is a lawn or a garden space directly to the south. People will enter from the southwest corner, which is on the lower left-hand side of this diagram, into the building, whether they come from the Capitol, the light rail, or other parking areas on the campus. There is a drop-off zone north or straight up along Park. If you go along Sherburn, there's a loading dock then that comes into the facility and supports both the legislative office building as well as the loading provisions for the Capitol itself. And then access to the below-grade parking is along Capitol Boulevard, which is between the administration ramp as well as this new legislative office building. Just to walk you through on page, the subsequent pages, page 4 is the lowest level of the project. It is what I would call the tunnel level. It connects directly to the tunnel that goes from this legislative office building to the Capitol as well as the legislative office building to the administration building. And this is the secure lower level parking for Senate and staff. The level above is on page 5 is the public entry to the building from the Capitol grounds. While they can use the tunnels, as I described earlier, they can also come on grade in that lower left-hand corner, and they would come into the building and either go up a stair or a set of elevators to what we would call the public concourse. On this level is the accessible public parking. I believe there's about 20 stalls in that location. This is where Senate Information Services would be, as well as the Sergeant at Arms loading dock and building support. As you go to the next page, page 6, this is really the public concourse or the public level, primary public level for the building. This is where we have the three primary hearing rooms that will be in this building. The hearing room on the left seats about 250 people. The other two seat about 150 each. Going further up on the upper floors, the second and the third floor are the primary office space for the building. These will house 44 senators on the two floors, as well as other support space such as minority and majority research, fiscal services, Senate Council, and the like. You'll see on page 7 as well on the upper left-hand corner is two areas called temporary committee rooms or temporary hearing rooms. Those are being carved out for use during the restoration of the Capitol, and they will become committee rooms for that interim time period. The photo on the image on page 9 represents what the building will look like from the corner of Sherburn and University. It is a combination of Minnesota granite and limestone, some precast materials as well as glass for the building. The following two pages, 10 and 11, are the view from Sherburn and Capitol Boulevard. And 10 represents the building as we hope or anticipate that it will be. We have asked and received approval from the Cap Board for possible height variation if we need to put the mechanical space on the upper level. We're still in in the design phase and are not sure if that will indeed be required. But on page 11, you can see what the building will look like if we indeed need to add that additional mechanical penthouse. I don't intend to go through every page, so I am moving rather quickly. You'll see, however, on page 13 and 14, it gives you a sense of the proportion of solid material to glass, both on the south side as well as on the north side. Some of these reflect both the use within the building as well as the solar orientation. Page 13, 16, and 17 are several options that we're continuing to look at related to the development of the entry from the lawn area on the south side. We will be developing those further in the next phase of the project. Turning to page 21, I'm going to now move over to Lot C, which is the above-grade parking ramp. This is a parking ramp that is bounded by Sherburn and Rice directly north of the Ford Building. We have accommodated access to that Ford Building and its loading dock as well as the small surface lot on the southeast corner through this design. This parking ramp is for 474 cars on three structured levels above a grade level. So there will be four levels total. We are structuring the footings and foundations.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas?
Just a quick question. So sure. This parking ramp is the one that's for the public parking?
Not, Mr. Chairman, Senator, that is correct.
We are structuring the footings and the foundations for this ramp.
Senator, go ahead.
To that point, I thought there were 20-some public places in the legislative office building also.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, there is, in the law that was passed, there was a requirement to have accommodate public accessibility ADA stalls within the parking on Lot B. So that is included in that 265 stall count. That is both to serve the legislative office building as well as the Capitol building. And that obviously has been an ongoing issue around access, providing access to the Capitol building. And this is a long-term solution to that, providing that access.
Thank you.
Sure. Just a couple of last comments. Again, the footings and foundations are being structured so that we can add two additional levels to the parking ramp on Lot C, should that be required at some future time. And then lastly, some of the images as it relates to the look and feel of the building. We are working with the Cap Board advisors to determine the actual color and of the brick and the precast. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, with that, if there's any questions related to that aspect of the presentation, we'd be happy to address those now.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, what's the Ford building going to be used for, since it looks like it's attached to that parking ramp?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that is still to be determined. Right now the Ford building is vacant. It has been vacant since 2000. You'll notice in that site plan we've provided for access off of Rice University, Rice Street, to allow for ongoing access to the Ford building. But that is the perennial issue of what to do with the Ford building is still outstanding.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Wozlaski, who owns the Ford building?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the state of Minnesota owns the Ford building.
And is the Ford building I'm not at all familiar with it. Is it formerly an office building?
Mr. Chair, Senator, there was that print operation in there when the state used to have a printing operation. There was also office space in there as well. It is in significant disrepair. There is no operating mechanical system. It's not heated. There is a host of issues with that building. It's been vacant and unheated for over 10 years.
So at least in your view, it would not be it wouldn't work for, say, temporary office spaces during capital restoration. Is that what you were really getting at?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that is, has been reviewed in the past and determined to be as expensive or more expensive than the other options that are available.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Other questions? Weslowski, anything further?
Mr. Chair, with that, just want to do a brief discussion on the budget as well. Within the packet of information that we sent with the letter from Commissioner Kronk, there is a cost summary that breaks down the total project cost of $89,450,000 between Lot B, the office building, and that associated parking is $75,825,000. The Lot C parking is $13,625,000. And one thing wanted to make sure the committee was aware that, you know, we are doing cost benchmarking with the assistance of Mortenson, as well as through CPMI, a private firm, to make sure that we are keeping the costs in line with the comparable facilities that have been constructed. And so we've done that benchmarking both on the parking ramp and the legislative building. The one thing I would add to that as well is when we're thinking about this building, we're thinking about it for the next, that the state is going to own this building for the next 100 years. And so the first costs are, although significant compared to the long-term costs over the life of the building. So we think about sustainability, about total cost of ownership over that period. So you want to design the mechanical systems and the rest of the material selection with that in mind to reduce your overall costs over the life of the building. So that is taken in consideration in our design as well.
Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weslowski, have there been contracts executed to this date on this project? And if so, with whom and for how much and under what authority were they executed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, in the authorizing legislation, there was also a $3 million general fund appropriation that was available for us to do the initial design work on the project. And we've executed a obviously there was a selection process where the team of Mortenson and BWBR was selected to be the design build team. We executed a contract with them for the preliminary design work. Any subsequent work, financing is needed, needs to be in place to go to the next stage of the project, which would be to start construction. Excuse me, finish design and start construction.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I'm actually a little concerned that this building is such a bare-bones building. I mean, no granite, no... It's asphalt and concrete, no art. How do we get, don't we have a law that says we have to do 1% for art in all public buildings? And how did the CAP board feel about this proposal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, on the percent for art question, it is permissive. It's a may. And when we submitted, there was a preliminary pre-design that was completed. At that time, we did not include any funding in that project budget for percent for art. There have been ongoing discussions about how could that happen at some point in the future, whether through donations or other mechanisms. The CAP board did approve the review, and they participated in the process, both the advisors and staff, through the workshops on the design. So we were getting feedback as we were designing the project, and the CAP board has taken action to approve the design. The two things that we have to go back to them for are on landscaping plan, as well as if we do end up needing to put mechanical systems on the roof, we would go back to the CAP board to show images of what that would actually look like.
Mr. Chairman, just one more question. So according to this chart, they talk about the new legislative building as being modern as opposed to neoclassical, which would fit more into the Capitol complex. I mean, heaven forbid, I know it's not the centennial, thank God, but And it looks pretty decent, but did we go in this direction instead of designing a neoclassical building that would be more consistent with the Capitol complex?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, and I'll turn to Catherine on this, but part of this process, it was an open workshop process, so there was participants from both House and Senate in that process, as well as staff. So through that workshop process, this was the design that moved forward. And I'll turn to Catherine if she has any additional comments on how the design team viewed that.
Well, we did look both proportionally at the proportion of windows and cornice lines and base, middle, and top of the Capitol. We think that those are indeed reflective in the design. I may have skipped over the full nature of all the materials. We do have a base of granite, and we have some Minnesota stone on the south side of the building, as well as precast. So it does have a significant amount of stone on the building.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pepper, I would also add that the design team did focus on how to this building should relate to the Capitol building, and a lot of discussions on, should it be similar, more neoclassical look like the state office building, or should it be more of a modern look? So there was a lot of debate back and forth, and I think there's probably a lot of opinions on what is the right solution for that. But part of the design of this building is intended to it was designed around its relation to the Capitol building, in particular around the relation to the dome as an element on the Capitol building. So you see that in the sight lines off the center corridor, particularly from the hearing room spaces, that it is intended to provide a relationship. So you always are connecting back to the Capitol building. But again, there's lots of differing opinions on should it have been neoclassical or a modern.
Mr. Wasilowski, do the per square foot cost of constructing the building, how does it compare to other office buildings or the most previously built state buildings? If we were to assume we'd have to adjust those to inflation from buildings that we previously built, but our per square foot costs, how do they compare?
Mr. Chair, Darren with Martinson comment on this as well, but we did do that benchmarking to compare this to on the Capitol campus. We've had the Anderson building and the Freeman building that were opened in 2005, so we had that cost information to compare to. And then we also had obviously Martinson's large portfolio of projects to compare to as well. On average, this project compares benchmarks within the range of costs that you see for this type of facility. The costs, there are some unique features of this building that help or impact the overall cost of the project. One of those, obviously, the hearing rooms and the technology associated with that has a cost impact. Senate media and its operations has an impact on that's not a function, obviously, that you see in other many other office building types. So there's some unique features that contribute to the cost, but overall, from a benchmarking standpoint, this fits in with other projects in the market. And with that, if Darren has any additional comments.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you, Darren Knapp with Mortenson. We took a look at 17 different projects, including state projects, to compare against our design and costing for LOB. The numbers I'm going to talk about are strictly for construction. They do not include design or land costs. So if we look at our project, we are roughly $268 a square foot. The prices range for the 17 comparable projects from $230 to over $415 a square foot. There are varying factors that impact that per square foot cost, size. Obviously, economies of scale come into play. And then one of the factors, as Mr. Wasilowski was mentioning, that is a driving factor in the cost of our project versus others is the density of the building itself, meaning the offices and the space that it's used for. If we look at Freeman and or Anderson, those are larger structures and more dedicated towards open offices. So to answer your question, Mr. Chair, Elmer Anderson is roughly $233 a square foot, and Freeman is roughly $257 a square foot. And the significant difference is they are significantly larger in size and significantly larger floor plates of open office.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to bring us back to a question that Senator Han brought up, and that's how contracts were awarded. We had a brief discussion about that during the committee. I was a member of that task force. Enjoyed working with the design team, but we never really even got into a discussion of how did this particular firm get awarded a contract, especially it raises a concern of mine since it was an out-of-state contractor. And we seem to be doing that a lot in the state of Minnesota. We're awarding huge contracts to contractors outside of the state of Minnesota and not to contractors here in Minnesota. I almost get a feeling that we have some type of lack of supply of contractors or designers. But could you review with me how the steps were made in awarding a contract? And then also if you could expand that to the Mortenson contract. Usually, I guess the way I see it is usually the blueprint comes first. And then you invite contractors to come in and give a bid. We didn't have a blueprint when a contractor was awarded. So could you explain to me how contractors are selected for this project?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, certainly. The delivery method in this case is a design-build delivery method, and the reason that method was selected was driven by the completion date. This project needs to be completed by June of 2015 in order for it to be used for swing space for capital restoration, and that is that was the key driver in selecting of the delivery method. You could use other delivery methods where you design the building first and then bid that project out. That would typically add almost a year to the timeline for the project. This process, and it was in the law that there was going to be a selection committee. There was three House members as well as three Senate members, and then one additional member on a selection committee. So there were seven total. There was an RFQ, request for qualifications, that was publicly issued that described the scope of the project and the schedule for the project. So there was a competition for submissions of qualifications on the project, and then the selection committee determined that the team of Mortenson and BWBR provided the best value for this project in their response. The Mortenson, and Darren can speak to this as well as Catherine to BWBR, these are Minnesota companies that have strong employment bases in Minnesota and have completed a tremendous amount of work in the state of Minnesota. So in this case, Darren, if you have any additional comments on that, but obviously they have a very significant presence, both firms, within the state of Minnesota.
Senator Limmer, anything further?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm thinking back on the 35W bridge when it collapsed. That bridge was put and reconstructed in almost a year's time. There was a specific urgency of completion date, yet that bridge was put out for bid. And construction was it not? I know that there's competing contractors in Minnesota that were participating in trying to get that contract, and not that we're discussing that today, but it seems like it's a different process for this one, even though the completion date is longer.
Mr. Chair,
I know that we were told that the Mortenson Company is a very good company. It has a long track record, but so does a lot of other corporations that are capable of building. I'm just trying to figure out how do we select out of a sea of contractors, how do we select one? And it, to me, I don't know if they have X, if we just go down a list of saying they have a track record, they have X number of bulldozers, they have the adequate labor force. A lot of companies have that. So how do we end up with one as opposed to others?
Mr. Wasilowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it is an open competitive process. There's that RF request for qualifications that issues has a detailed list of not only qualifications of the firms that are competing, it's also qualifications of the team members that are going to be participating on the project. So first of all, there's a competition on qualifications and experience with similar projects on delivering those projects. Again, this is an open competition. Anybody who thinks they're qualified and wants to compete for this work can had the opportunity to do so. It also is competing on fees. So they had to submit what their fees were going to be for the project. And so there's a cost element of that competition as well. So from that standpoint, from a public procurement standpoint, this was an open competitive process. I think part of what your question is just related to the delivery method itself is unique in that it's a common delivery method in the industry. It's not, and it's more common on the transportation side than it is on the building side for in the public sector. But it is a delivery method that obviously combines the talents of both the contractor and the design firm right away in the design process, so they're both at the table. The contractor's there checking the cost estimates for the elements that the design team is proposing. The design build team is able to look from a procurement standpoint, how are we going to procure this project, how are we going to sequence it. So from a scheduling standpoint, they're able to phase the work in a way that is logistically most efficient and helps us deliver the project faster. So from a delivery method standpoint, this is a tight schedule for delivery of this project. We don't have to meet a June 2015 date. We need to move very efficiently. So that is part of what goes into the.
Senator Limmer, there were three companies that actually responded to the RFQ. All Minnesota companies. Mortenson, through the scoring process of that selection committee, was selected to be the builder. Senator Cohen, then Senator Hand.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to make that comment. I wasn't part of the committee process, but it was my understanding that there were several companies that responded to what was put out, but any company could have. And from what I understand, I think all the companies that did respond were Minnesota companies. Relative to the design-build process, I've had involvement off and on, but I think the revenue building was design-build. I think there have been some buildings at the University of Minnesota that have been design-build. And Mr. Wasilowski is certainly the expert within state government, but would be able to delineate how often we've used the design-build process as opposed to a more comprehensive process. It's not unique or unusual at all. The other comment I'd make is that, I don't know if this gives Senator Limmer any comfort, but if I'm not mistaken, I think, Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee were two majority, one minority. I think what Senator Senjum was your appointment to the committee. Am I mistaken?
I think so.
Right. Okay, so Senator Senjum was a participant throughout this process. Obviously, he's not here, but he could speak to his involvement in the selection process. And I think it was what, Mr. Chairman, yourself and Senator Rest and Senator Senjum, is that correct, on the Senate side? And I know I haven't heard complaints from any of the three senators involved as to the process or the deliberations within the process.
Just for the record, I do believe, Mr. Wasilowski, wasn't the I-35 bridge done on his design-build contract?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In the transportation sector, there, that's a fairly common delivery method as well. So in both, and Senator Cohen is right, this is a delivery method used on the Stassen building, the retirement systems building. U of M has used it on a number of projects. Minsky has as well.
Senator Marty, then Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Wislowski, when I look at the floor plan, I don't know what floor it is, level two, you have some temporary committee rooms, which I believe Ms. Lanitas talked about, calling those swings-based temporary committee rooms. Is that the assumption then that after this is complete, some of the Senate hearing rooms will be in the Capitol still? Because I really like the fact you're having bigger hearing rooms. I think that's helpful, but I also see when you list the number of hearing rooms in the Capitol now, it says four Senate, two House, and I keep thinking we often use, I've seen 125 used as a hearing room and 318 or something, which are not really room, I mean, they're not appropriate rooms for it. So I just wonder, you're going to have three permanent hearing rooms here, you're assuming others in the Capitol?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, yes, the three permanent and then two temporary in the legislative office building. And this is, again, critical to capital restoration. In the 2016 legislative session, the plan is for the Senate chambers as well as the hearing room functions to happen in this legislative office building. The Capitol, all of that wing will be under restoration. So the Senate chambers would not be available for the 2016 session in the Capitol building. So that is, again, driving towards that completion date.
The short session.
Within the Capitol, the plan for the Capitol, we have four hearing rooms that are designated for the Senate. They're all equivalent, roughly the three are equivalent to the size of room 123 today. That, along with the hearing room G15. There will be one additional hearing room for the House, and then there's a second room that is it's going to be designated for the Historical Society as a classroom, but that's going to be available at the end of sessions should there need to be conference committees in that room. So the idea is to continue to have conference committees held within the Capitol building.
Well, I should say that it's very clear in state statute that the space allocation plan relative to the Capitol, the Senate has a certain number of space, a certain number of rooms today, and for that to change, this building is critical. I mean, without this new building, the Capitol is going to look much different in its renovations than how admin is currently working on it with the contractors. So. The two projects are very closely linked together. Senator Newman. Oh, Senator Martin, I'm sorry. Yeah, Senator Martin,
Mr. Chair, yeah, I did have a follow-up. So in other words, in the end, I understand the difficulty during the transition, but when the Capitol is rebuilt, there will be three in this building and two more in the Capitol? I'm talking Senate hearing rooms.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, there will be four in the Capitol that are for the Senate.
So we will have more hearing rooms than we have now total between the two.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, you will have one more than you currently have. I think the challenge in counting that number is when you use the smaller rooms that you use now, like 125. If you're counting that as a hearing room, then...
I wasn't counting it, but it's been used.
So in my count, I'm counting that as a hearing room. When I say one more, it includes, you're including 125, you're including 318.
Which are inadequate rooms.
Yes.
Senator Cohen, unless to this subject?
Yeah, no, we've got four hearing rooms right now in the Senate. We've got this room, 112, 123, and 15.
Currently. But if we include 125 and 318, which are very poor hearing rooms, we actually have six. But
Mr. Chair, and that's how we were looking at it, is you do have the need. It basically gets to the need for hearing room space. You do utilize 318 and 125 on occasion. So that's when we were looking at it, we were trying to accommodate that overall need that you have for hearing rooms.
So
Wait.
Go ahead. No,
Senator Marty, any further?
If she's on the, I have another thing, but.
We have to move to Senator Newman, then Senator Fischbach, then Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, Mr. Wasilewski, you indicated, I think, that design build was chosen as the method to proceed because of a deadline regarding the capital restoration. So my question is, if this had been let pursuant to a competitive bid process, would it be fair to assume that there would have been a cost savings to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, first of all, I would say this was a competitive selection process. And then I'd also add that a significant amount of work that happens under this contract gets subsequently bid by Mortenson to subcontractors. So from that standpoint, you'd have to weigh not only the cost of the overall project, it's the work is getting competitively bid. So, and we're checking that with independent folks to make sure that we're getting competitive pricing through the process. So,
Mr. Wasilewski, what I'm referring to specifically is the competitive bid process under the statute versus the design build process under pursuant to statute. And I understand that you are stating that this was competitively bid, but not pursuant to the competitive bid process.
Yep.
And my specific question is it fair to assume that if it had been subject to a competitive bid process under the statute, there would have been a cost savings to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I'd first go back to the cost benchmarking that we have completed, both with comparing it to other state buildings as well as other projects that Mortenson has competed. The pricing that we're getting on this project from an estimating standpoint puts us within the range of other similar projects. So from that standpoint, it's difficult to say that if we would have went through, contracted separately for the design, completed the design work, and then bid out that set of construction documents, whether or not we would have got different pricing.
The answer is you don't believe there would have been a cost savings. Is that, am I accurate in that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, the answer that I'm giving is that we've cost benchmarked and we are checking our costs that we're getting against market conditions and against past projects to ensure that, and we're also from a procurement standpoint making sure we have competition for the subcontract work to make sure we're getting competitive pricing on the project. Senator, I'm not trying to.
One of the driving factors was the contracts had been let on the capital restoration, and the delay in the capital work. If we had taken an additional year to complete the other building, the cost overruns on that would have been, I don't know how many in the millions, tens of millions probably, of cost overruns on the capital, because the capital contracts had already been secured. So it's the timeline was driving, I think, admin's decision as much as anything else, because we're subjected to considerable cost overruns on the capital renovations because of the linkage. Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I've got a couple of things. I've been taking notes since everybody's talking, but you mentioned, Mr. Chair, that the two projects, the Capitol and the new building, are linked together, and I believe so, too, and I'm just curious as to where the plans for the Capitol are, because if we need to understand what's going to be in the Capitol before we can build a new building, and so and you've said a few things that lead me to believe that there may be some plan somewhere, but nobody's been privy to that, or there's things going on. Senator Limmer mentioned to me this morning before the meeting in conversation that he sits on that committee and they haven't met about the Capitol, haven't met. Nobody has plans. I'm looking at this sheet. It says that there's going to be, and I'm assuming they're talking about, and I don't know who handed this out because nobody claimed ownership of it. It looks like there's going to be minority leader offices. I don't think Senator Hahn is aware of that. He hasn't been told. There's no discussion about what's going to be in the Capitol. How can we build a building if we don't know what we need? We don't know what we have. We don't know what we're doing here. And you yourself, Mr. Chair, said that those two were linked. So I'm just curious as to how we, and it's very confusing.
Senator Fischbach, the final floor plan of what the Capitol is going to look like is totally contingent on the new building. The Senate currently owns this real estate in this room. The House wants it for a caucus room. The same is true for 112. But currently, the Senate has this space under the space allocation agreement. We cannot sign this space away and tell admin to proceed with remodeling this into a House caucus room when the Senate, if the new building for some reason doesn't happen, where are we going to put the Senate if we have signed a new space allocation agreement and given this room up? So the final plans, there are some preliminary plans, assuming the new building goes forward, but the final floor plans of the Capitol have not been completed. The Senate has not surrendered any of its space under the current allocation agreement because we simply can't until we know we're going to have a place to go.
So, Mr. Chair, those negotiations are all going on behind closed doors. There's nothing public about what's going to happen with the very public Capitol?
We do not know yet. There have been some preliminary discussions basically about how many square feet the Senate is going to continue to have in this building. We do know that we're going to the Senate will lose about 23,000 feet to stairways, restrooms, elevators, different handicap related modifications that need to be made, code changes to update the Capitol for code purposes. We are going to lose a lot of space just to that. What the law says on the space allocation, and the Senate Republican Caucus wrote it into law in the 2012 bonding bill, is that any change in the space allocation agreement has to be signed off on by four parties: the chief clerk on the part of the House, the Secretary of the Senate on the part of the Senate, the Attorney General, and the Supreme Court Chief Judge. That's who has to sign off on a change in the space allocation. And there have been preliminary discussions about how much space is the Senate going to surrender and what might the new renovated Capitol look like, but nothing has been executed because the new building has to be on its way before the Senate can give up any of its space.
And Mr. Chair, just one more on that. Is that all being done behind closed doors, essentially? The committee that has been set up for it has not been informed about it, I guess. And I understand you said they're preliminary discussions, but is that not something that you involve a committee that's set up for that process to at least? It shouldn't be a secret. I mean, even if they're just preliminary, this can be a discussion of the public. Maybe there's some public input, which we are greatly lacking in this process. Maybe there is some possibility that the public wants input. I mean, I guess I'm really curious about why the public or other senators, anybody's not.
Mr. Wislosky.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, there is a Capital Preservation Commission meeting scheduled for next Tuesday. And I would just want to be clear, we proceeded with the capital restoration plans based on the authorization for this new building. So we're currently at the design development completion phase for the capital restoration projects. That's what we're going to be reviewing with the Preservation Commission next week. Throughout this process, we've been meeting with the stakeholders throughout the effort to walk through and understand what the functional requirements are, and then making that all work within a plan. So that is up for the Preservation Commission next week. Obviously, that is, again, it was going back to, you know, last year, we had about this time, we had a space report that was due under the initial authorization for capital restoration. And it listed, you know, these same issues that we're talking about now. What are the functional, who's going to be in the Capitol building, who should be in the Capitol building, how much space is going to be taken up by mechanical life safety systems, what are the options for dealing with that space. Out of that report came then the study for the new legislative office building and then the authorization. So from an administration standpoint, we've been proceeding based on that authorization, and the design development plans reflect that. So it doesn't reflect the current space allocation in the Capitol. It reflects what the space allocation would be with the new legislative office building. So there would be as the chair is indicating, significant impacts to capital restoration if we have to, or if the direction is to look at other options at this point.
And Mr. Chair, might I ask who did hand this out? Is anybody, because this does have some definite decisions on, you know, it's going to have a dedicated capital state some things that are going to be, that are going to exist in the capital. And so I'm just, nobody handed this out? I guess I'm just curious.
Well, Senator Fischbach, it's based on the preliminary work that admin has been doing on the renovations of the capital.
All right, because Mr. Chair, in the state office building now, and I don't know, there is a minority conference. I mean, I would think that this is inaccurate. It says dedicated conference rooms or caucus rooms, or is this going to be under the new state office building? Because right now we do, the minority does have a dedicated caucus room in their area. So I guess I'm just kind of, so this was admin put this together?
No, actually, my office put this together based on the conversations that we've had with admin relative to what would a new space allocation look like, because it's the Senate giving up space in the Capitol. The conversations that have happened, there's 23,000 feet that need to be reallocated for all the life and safety issues. The governor wants more space in the conversations with him. The House wants a significant more space in the conversations we've had with them. So kind of involving those stakeholders, the governor on behalf of the Historical Society has requested that they have a staging area to set tours up to come through the Capitol. So there have been a number of stakeholders involved in what would this new renovation of the Capitol encompass. This is all very preliminary because it's all totally contingent upon a new building for the Senate to move most of its functions into.
Well, and Mr. Chair, it sounds like there's a lot of discussions going on. Wouldn't it be prudent to involve a member of the minority so it didn't appear partisan? Just a suggestion. But I do have a follow-up for Mr. Wasloski, if I could. Senator Limmer had asked a little bit about the Minnesota companies. And as I recall, I've attended a few meetings where there's a lot of folks who are not from Minnesota involved. And you left the impression, and I understand these two great Minnesota companies are here represented, but there are some other companies that we've contracted with that are not. And I just wanted to make sure that the impression that we're only using Minnesota folks is cleared up, because that's, I think you did kind of leave that impression. So if you could tell me potentially where are some of the other companies from that have been involved that don't seem to be here today?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I think maybe you're referring to the BWBR has partnered with Picard Chilton on the design work. So I think maybe that's who you've seen in the meetings and are referring to. And maybe Catherine could just comment on the relationship between BWBR and Picard Chilton.
Sure. Catherine Leonidas, Mr. Chair, Senator. John Picard, Picard Chilton, has been contracted with us as well as part of this design team. Their primary involvement is in the early phases of the project, in the schematic design and design development. They will actually be tapering off their role during the rest of the project, and we will continue to be the architect of record and develop the drawings further, as well as working with Mortensen on the construction.
And, Mr. Chair, they're from Massachusetts, as I recall.
Connecticut.
Okay,
yes.
That was close.
Yeah.
Same accent. Right? but then there's some there, and there are some other companies, Mr. Chair, Mr. Wasloski. There are some other companies. I mean, that wasn't the only folks that I recall from being from out of state. Mr. Chair, is that a Mr. Hart?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, on the consultant side, the project management side. Again, through a competitive process with participation from House and Senate staff, the team of CPMI and MOCA, they teamed up to submit a proposal to provide project management on the legislative office building. CPMI is a local firm, has a strong presence in Minnesota. MOCA is David Hart, has been working on capital restoration, obviously knew the space requirements, and has that experience with legislative hearing rooms. So through that competitive process, that team was selected to provide project management services on the project. So other than that, other contracts let, we've been doing geotechnical testing. That's Braun Intertech. That's a Minnesota company. We have survey work that's been done, Minnesota company. So there's, as with any project of this nature, it's not all Minnesota companies, but it is done through an open competitive process.
Thank you.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wazlowski, and I want to go back to the comment that you were saying earlier on as this discussion was initiated, that a lot of this is being driven by a date, June of 2015, where this needs to be done, and that as a result of that, some of the decisions made about the contracts and the timing and so forth. And I'm assuming when you say that, it would suggest that if we didn't build this building or if it were delayed, that would have a bearing on the capital restoration. I think, Senator Bach, you'd mentioned that there is this interplay. I'm concerned about that because I don't know that we've ever had any hearings about how the capital restoration is going to play into this space allocation issue or whether it's prudent for the Senate to cede the square footage in the Capitol that has traditionally been our office space to the House or to the governor or to the Historical Society or to whoever else. Those seem to me to be the kinds of questions that ought to be heard in some public hearing so that they can be vetted, debated, and everybody has an opportunity to see what those decisions are. It seems to me that this what's happened here is we have a capital restoration project that we all agree needs to be done. And then as a part of that, there was some decision said, well, it's going to cause some disruption to the building, so maybe we should build another building to account for that disruption. So for this two-year period or so that we are going to be in disruption, the solution is let's build a new building. And then the context of that building is being driven by that presumption, which seems to me a little bit like putting the cart before the horse. I'm very concerned about this process, this project, having had the opportunity to be fully understood before we've gone down the path. And now we're going to take this next step, presumably, saying, yep, let's go forward with it, when there are a lot of questions that many of us don't see the clear answer for why those decisions were made or what decisions will be made, how they will be made going forward. Could you tell us what happens if we don't proceed with this building as far as the capital restoration? Is it off track? Are we going to be put on hold? What's the plan if we decide, well, we're not going to do this? What if we want to keep our footprint in the Capitol as far as the Senate is concerned? What happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, and I'll start with maybe some background will be helpful. In 2000, there was a pre-design done on capital restoration, and that report concluded that in order to meet the space requirements of the tenants, a new building was needed and recommended. That obviously didn't move forward. In 2006, 2007, a new effort was done on capital restoration. The building continued to deteriorate. We started to see more significant issues with the Capitol building. And at that time, there was a recommendation. Again, it was the question of can you get all Senate in the Capitol building, and there was a plan to expand the Capitol building to the south. And significant design work was done towards that effort, and it was a below-grade expansion, and that would have provided all the senators to be within the Capitol building. Approximately $3 million worth of design costs on that plan. That project didn't move forward. 2009 is when we started seeing scaffolding come up around the Capitol building because of the deteriorating condition of the exterior stone. That, again, got everybody looking again, okay, how are we going to accomplish capital restoration? And that led to the formation of the Preservation Commission, the Capital Preservation Commission, and that the intent behind that commission was it was a bipartisan effort, top leadership of state government participating and taking responsibility for preservation of the Capitol building. That plan, that commission approved a master plan in 2012, and then the legislature did an initial funding for capital restoration of about $44 million. The space issue was always out there. The constraints of, and you see it in the report from last year on the space. First of all, the legislature asked us to prepare a report, a recommendation on space for the Capitol building because they acknowledged the issues around and the challenges around space. That report identified, you know, both from a hearing room standpoint and because of some of the impacts that they were going to, when we come in, the things that Senator Bach mentioned related to mechanical systems, life safety, some of the space that we lost through that process. How are we going to address those unmet needs? That's what got us down this, the request then came to what would a new office building cost and what would it look like. So then we did a preliminary study on that, and then the authorization came. So we've been proceeding based on that authorization with capital restoration, that that's how the space needs were going to be met. We have both a short-term issue and a long-term issue. The short-term issue is what do we do with the current tenants. Obviously, we have to move people out to accomplish restoration. This coming after the 2014 session, we're moving everybody out of the east wing of the Capitol, turning that space over to the contractor. So we have to find spaces to fill that in. In June of 2015, the entire building is under, Capitol building is under restoration. So we have to have space for all the current tenants in the building. 2016, the challenge is you need about 18 months per wing to complete the restoration work. Obviously, we don't, and we're already requiring the contractor to work around an occupied building, so that is already, there's some inefficiencies in doing that. To achieve a December 2016 date, we have to be able to say to the contractor, June of 15, we're going to give you all the space within the Capitol. 2016, we're still looking at keeping the floor sessions only for the house within the Capitol, and that's where we need the where are we going to hold the floor sessions for the Senate, as well as where do the senators go. So that's kind of the sequence that's driving it. And if this building, the new building doesn't happen, we would be looking out, you know, there's not available space in state-owned buildings on the campus to move the existing tenants to. So we'd be looking out to the lease market to say, you know, what could we do on a short-term basis? And it isn't the square footage costs, it's the build-out costs that would be involved in temporarily standing up a chambers as well as offices for senators and staff. You're trying to recoup that cost over a two-year period. That's going to be a when you say multiple millions of dollars, it's multiple millions of dollars to do that.
And Mr. Chair, and Mr. Chair and Mr. Wozniak, I appreciate that. Thank you for the review. It's helpful. But I will just tell you that my sense is that many of us who believed and still believe that the capital restoration project is important, we need to do it. I don't think that a lot of us were saying when we looked at that and said, yeah, we need to do that. And that means as well we have to have a new building. That link was never, to my recollection, made clear. And if that was in the mind of you and others as you proceeded with capital restoration, that is done presuming another building, I think that probably should have been a discussion point at the time we took up capital restoration and made it clear that, well, if we're really going to do this, you know, there may be a lot of options, as you pointed out. You could lease space, you could do other things, you could try to work around, you know, but we're going to choose the solution of building another building. And so when we go down this path, when we say to the legislature, vote for capital restoration, you're also, in effect, voting for another building. That's what it seems like you're telling us. And I'm a little concerned about that because I don't recall having that discussion. I don't recall having hearings about that. I don't recall any of that. But now it seems like if we don't do this, you're saying we're going to be in a big hole. We're going to be in a big problem here. We don't have contingency plans. We don't have alternatives. We don't have another thing. It's all presuming this building gets built. I'm concerned about that, that this process is being driven by something that for many of us was unrelated to a new building.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, a couple things. Senator Hanna, first of all, I'm not sure you intend this, but your comments toward Mr. Wozlowski are directed as if he's the driving force. Mr. Wozlowski has worked in his capacity for, I think, several administrations. He simply implements what he's been given. I've worked with him on some projects, and he's not the driving force behind this. And he's not the person who's saying...
And Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, then who is? We did not have hearings on this building.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hanna, that was the next point I wanted to make. I've not been a driving force on this. and have not been involved with this on a day-to-day basis. But as the chairman's pointed out, Senator Bach has pointed out, that as we got into this, what everybody talked about, and there was certainly discussion within the Senate about this, were the inadequacy of restrooms, the fact that the HVAC system simply didn't work in the context of the 2000s as opposed to 40 or 50 years ago, that there were concerns about the public and the inaccessibility of the public to the Capitol in terms of hearing space, not so much the real volatile kinds of issues like marriage equality and guns and so on, which bring unusually large crowds, but just in the public accessibility to the Senate and what happens with the Senate. You know, the House addressed those concerns with what was a very significant redoing of the state office building in the mid-1980s, and I recall some of that as a House member. There was discussion of how to, in effect, fit, as the cliche goes, the round peg into the square hole. And there were other considerations. The governor, for instance, talked about some of the difficulties, and I had heard this from not Governor Plenty, but I've heard it from people within his administration as to the difficulty governors were having in terms of operation of their office in the context of the present space. That when this building was built in 1905, obviously things were simpler, easier. Minnesota had a significantly smaller population. And when the attempt was made to try to figure out all of these kinds of issues, that what it led to was that you would simply not have room for the state Senate. And Mr. Chairman, just parenthetically, I thought one of the appeals of this thing was something that former Senator Knutson, Dave Knutson, and I had talked about, I forget when, obviously when he was still in the Senate, that people kind of nodded their heads and said, gee, that'd be a great idea. And I thought it was a spectacular idea, and that was to make sure that both majority and minority members were in the state capitol at the same time in terms of their offices. And this was certainly well before the DFL was in the minority. And when Senator Knutson and I had those discussions, I mean, to be honest, there was not a contemplation that the DFL would be in the minority at that time. And everybody seemed to think that that was a great idea, but nobody really seemed to do anything about it. I think for the sake of governance of not just the Senate but the state, I think having both parties, the senior members in the Capitol building would be spectacular, and having both parties in another building. You know, we have a combination, and we don't have the segregation that that we experience now, I think would make a difference in this place. And so when you look at all the gamut of those issues, the host of those issues, as Senator Bach has pointed out, eventually something, someplace, the toothpaste or whatever the cliches are, gets squeezed out of the toothpaste tube. And I think that's what leads to some of this. And the last comment, Senator Hahn, is I think it's striking until, there was talk about things, red herring kinds of issues that don't even exist, the Olympic-sized swimming pool or whatever it was. Maybe it was an Olympic-sized, but, the motion picture screening room and the sound studio, whatever else was
That's
talked about.
It,
well,
tub.
Exactly. It wasn't in here. And until there was talk about things that weren't even contemplated, it seemed that people in the Senate and other people in the government thought that this would work out well for state governments.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Sarah Cohen, and you've mentioned a lot of things that I think could very well be very good things. The idea of having members in the same building and lots of things. But the way you've described this is you've sort of described this as a process that just sort of happened. It evolved. Things got decided. And now here we are. And some of us are looking at it and say,
I don't recall having the debate about what are we going to do? Are we going to try to retain the space in the Capitol for the Senate? Are we going to let it go to another building? You know, all these things that happen, and the decision that we are at today is we're making a decision to proceed with a defined project. And yet none of the antecedent issues were vetted in any kind of a hearing or any kind of a debate or any kind of a public discussion the way you've described, and I think you're right, is that people talked. You know, there was conversations about this and that. Wouldn't it be good to do this or that? And somewhere along the line, it seems like the admin folks have sort of taken ownership of this thing, and they say, well, you know, we're going to have to do this capital restoration anyway. This would be a good thing to kind of marry up with that. And so, okay, we've got this date, and, you know, and off we go. And the train has left the station. That is not good governance, in my opinion. And that's part of the problem that I'm trying to raise here, is that this project is very large, is very encompassing, lots of issues that should be vetted, should have those discussions, those debates. But they never happened. At least they never happened publicly. They never happened in a place where people could talk about that and hear input and vote on stuff. It just sort of happened. And now here we are. We've got this plan. We've got this project. That, to me, raises real issues about this. And I think some of the consternation that we have on our side about proceeding is that these issues maybe should have a fuller discussion, just with respect to the process, the project itself. So I don't disagree with you. You're raising good points. But there was never any public hearing, formal decision-making. It all just kind of evolved. That's not the way we should do it.
Mr. Chairman, did Senator Senjum convey some of this to you? Because you appointed him to...
Chairman and Senator Cohen, I did not appoint him. The Rules Committee appointed him. They didn't ask me formally about it. It was an appointment by the Rules Committee, as I recall. And I'm not objecting to that because I respect Senator Senjum. And, there are things that happen...
Mr. Chairman, was that your recommendation to the chairman of the Rules Committee?
I don't recall that it was. I think it was just a... I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look. But that's not the point. The point is the decisions that we're talking about, the space allocation, the what is the best way to deal with the restoration in conjunction with the space that the Senate needs. How do those decisions get made? Who's driving this project, to go back to your point? If it's not admin, who is? Because there was never any formal process to say, here's the decision we're making, let's all vote and say, do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
So, Senator Hand, there are previous space allocation agreements, and the most recent one was signed in 2003. There was not a public process in space allocation. There's none required in law. The law simply says that these four parties have to agree to who's going to take ownership of whatever space in the Capitol or in the state office building. So there's not a public process. There never has been one as related to space allocation of the two buildings. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that particularly,
Senator,
I guess I would appreciate that you say that there's not, Mr. Chair, there wasn't a public hearing on the allocation. But I think in this case, we're spending a lot of money, public tax dollar money, on those allocations and building an entirely new building, spending a lot more money. And I think that's where we're talking about the public being involved and having some information on this. I don't disagree that in 2003 that there was probably some shuffling of offices, but there wasn't this significant amount of money being changed.
Senator Fischbach, a lot of money was spent when the Judicial Center was built, too, and the judiciary vacated the Capitol, the suites that I'm in. And I'm pretty sure we can look back, and there wasn't a public process about who was going to get the judiciary space when they moved into their new building.
And Mr. Chair,
a lot of money was spent then also.
And Mr. Chair, a lot of money was spent on the new building, not renovating the Capitol. And Mr. Chair, I appreciate your arguments, but they're not quite consistent. Mr. Chair, we're building a new building and spending a whole lot of money, and we're renovating the entire Capitol. And that's where I think that Senator Hand is talking about the public input. And I know that there's others who want to
speak. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In having this discussion, I think we're beginning to exemplify a degree of frustration. And I think it's whenever you're moving one or two buildings and moving the services or function of one building to another, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, and you're trying to figure out how to do this, if that's the choice you've made to go forward with the project. the uneasiness of some, including myself, is that being a member of both the design commission for the new building and also being a member of the capital preservation committee, that particular commission has not had a meeting since mid-July. And so at least inviting the members of that preservation commission. So 5-6 months have gone by. We keep hearing, I guess it's rumor, that certain areas of the Capitol building are now being gobbled up by the administration or the AG's office. Talks are going on. Workers in this building will tell you that they're working in specific areas of the Capitol for a future AG space. And so you get the impression that decisions have been made, lines have been drawn, and now we have to build this new building, and there's no choice. So I think there's an uneasiness simply because I haven't been invited to a commission meeting for nearly 5-6 months. I thought that this would have been as ongoing as the other commission would have been, at least maybe not on the detail that the design commission was working under this past year, but the capital preservation, well, we're kind of in the dark, and I think that's what's bringing a frustration to the table. We don't know. We may know what we may get, but we don't know what we're leaving. And when there's an opportunity that, you know, Senator Cohen had suggested years ago, and I remember looking at some of the line drawings of how to incorporate all the Senate members into the Capitol. But we also know that there's another chamber that has to approve the use of the Capitol building for that purpose, and they're not so revved up on that idea. So I can understand the frustration that's surfacing, but I wish we would have a little more meetings with the Capitol Preservation Committee because we would have a better understanding of where we're coming from and where we're going and the time frame involved. And so now we're having this unease about what we're trying to do because we really don't know the other half of it. Are we at the point of no return at the Capitol? Some may think that. Question of having 2/3 of the senators being in the Capitol or the building across the street. And now we have this bifurcated location. I can only see that as being difficult for management. But be it as it may, I think July 22nd was the last time the Capital Preservation Commission on whole even had a meeting. And so I'm in the dark even as a member of that, where we're going.
Mr. Wasilowski on the Capital Preservation Commission.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, and you're right, there was two meetings, one in July and then a follow-up meeting in, it was July 22nd. There was a previous meeting July 8th. And you'll recall in the July 8th meeting, the governor was expressing, as chair of the commission, some frustration that the space allocation decision was not under the purview of the commission. And we had quite a bit of debate on that and discussion on that, but the fact is there is a law that was passed that gives the space allocation decision to each of the tenants. So when we, in implementing that law, we were working with each of the tenant representatives to walk through what are the functional requirements for the Senate, what are the House, Attorney General, Supreme Court. So we had numerous meetings with the tenant reps for each of those tenants. And so that approval process, as the chair has pointed out, is with each of the tenants and not with the Preservation Commission. You know, throughout, after approval of schematic design, and the commission, you know, reviewed the plans for the Capitol and approved schematic design and work package one. So the construction work that is happening now was approved by the commission, as well as that preliminary set of designs. Since then, we've had numerous design meetings, six design development meetings where, you know, we open that up to whoever is able to attend, and I certainly understand and acknowledge that it's not easy for everybody to do. Everybody else has other work to do, so it's not easy to attend every meeting, but we try to make that as a public and open process as possible for the stakeholders to participate. But part of the frustration, I think, and the governor expressed that in particular, I think, in the July 8th meeting about the The decision regarding space was not a preservation commission's decision in statute. It was designated to tenant representatives. And so that, you know, fought, and it did fall past, you know, past negotiations around space around the Capitol. So I'm happy to, you know, provide whatever information is needed on where we're at on space in the Capitol. I can say that there are a number of things that I think I think there will be strong support for, the providing event space for the public, providing some additional dining seating capacity off of the Raskeller, a classroom for the Historical Society. You know, so those combined are some of the part of the charge of the Preservation Commission was to the three principles passed. One of them was around functionality. The other two, architectural integrity and life safety. So that it was about thinking about the functionality of the Capitol building for the next 100 years. And I think that's what the people that have been involved have been working towards.
Senator Lummer, admin, and Mr. Wesolowski as the designated negotiator, I guess, in the Capitol space, is following the law in the process. We put this piece in your packet, so you don't have to dig for it. I'll just read it. It's pretty brief. Statute 15B.155, Subdivision 1, consultation and collaboration. The commissioner shall consult and collaborate with representatives designated by the governor, the majority leader of the Senate, the Speaker of the House, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the Attorney General of the Capitol Area and Architectural Planning Board, the Director of the Minnesota Historical Society, regarding the design and construction process for the restoration of the Capitol building. That is what admin has been doing. That is the direction that we gave them in law, and I believe it was actually passed in 12. It was passed in 2012 in the bonding bill. So they have been following the course that this legislature put them on with the tenants.
Well, Mr. Chair, perhaps my characterization of the frustration we're going under is misguided. I was under the impression that the reason why we were having so much frustration in this discussion was that we didn't know what the progress of the Capitol restoration and some of the remodeling and reallocation of space was. Now you've just said that admin and the leaders of the House and Senate, among others, are the ones that are really having those discussions and negotiations.
Well, Senator Lummer, we put the statutory language in your packet, so you have it, and it was passed in the 2012 bonding bill.
It kind of raises a question, Mr. Chair, of what a member of a Capital Preservation Commission member actually does if he doesn't get invited to a meeting, because there are no meetings for 4 or 5 months at a time. Why do we have the commission when other people are negotiating the whole thing?
Mr. Wesolowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lummer, you're correct that the involvement of the commission in accordance with the statute that was passed creating the commission, it had a more significant role in the front end of the project, in developing and approving a master plan for the restoration. And then subsequent after that approval of the master plan, there was the commission, Preservation Commission language was passed in 2011. February 2012, the commission approved a master plan for the preservation of the Capitol. Then we received the initial appropriation to start that work. When we have started that work, that 2012 appropriation is what is being referred to, outlined some parameters that we had to follow when we're implementing that work. And that, you're right, the original 2011 authorization of the commission had much more involvement in developing the master plan, coming up with the three principles that were going to, architectural integrity, functionality, and life safety, those guiding principles. Subsequent, there's been other approvals that have been put in place in law that we've been following, the approval on how the space discussions would happen. Going back to the commission, the points in law where we have to go back to the commission are approval of work packages and for schematic design and design development. So that's the process we've been following.
Senator Skoy, then Senator Marty, then Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to go back to Senator Newman's comment of a while ago with regard to design build. And it really had questions about how you can speed up the timeline and have cost savings at the same time. And the background that I bring to this is I served on the Transportation Committee when much of the design build discussion was taking place. And as Mr. Waslowski has said, transportation has led the way in design build. We have used it for buildings now in the past because of the cost savings and the timeline benefits. And a lot of that comes from the flexibility that you have in the process, where you bring the builder and the designer in early on, and they are doing the design as they're doing the building. And that's the flexibility that you get. That brings problems when you are a committee and you want to know exactly what you're going to get. And in the Transportation Committee on some of these bridge projects where we were using design build, the committee members wanted to know, well, what's the bridge going to look like? Well, they didn't know because they were going through the design build process, and it becomes relevant and aware as the process progresses. But the result of that is you get a faster timeline, as we did on the 35W bridge, and you also get cost savings. And if you talk to people who do estimatings in the construction business, they really like the design build because when you're going along and you happen to figure out that your air duct goes through the elevator shaft, you can fix it before it's such a major problem. And so while we're kind of frustrated today because we don't have all the answers on this building or all the answers on all space designation, in the long run, it will allow us to meet the time constraints of finding a place for the Senate to be, because if they do take the, if there are changes made to space allocation in the Capitol, we got to be somewhere. And so I think part of the frustration of this discussion we're having today is because design build is being used, but it's the only way we can meet the time constraints that we have. And in the end, I think we will have cost savings.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who this is addressed to, Mr. Waslowski or whomever, but his background, I don't care where my office is. I've been in the Capitol most years, been in state office, but I don't care if we're in Centennial Building or whatever. And I don't have the background on this because I've never served on the Capital Investment Committee. So when Senator Cohen and others were talking about this 2006-2007 plan to put everyone in the Capitol, I was never involved in that, and I've always been one who thinks we ought to put everybody in the same building. And that's one of the questions I guess I have. I understand that one of the reasons for not putting, you can't put another floor on because the cap board height restrictions, and then I hear, well, you're talking about putting mechanical there that would require a variance or something from them. I'm wondering, because I think if we look 50 years ahead, people might be asking why we aren't all in the same building. And I mean, state office building, this is very similar to that in style where you have office next to office next to office in the Senate minority suite. And I think that works better for members connecting with each other. I like that. I guess I'm wondering why there was less discussion of trying to ask about maybe one more floor, if that wouldn't wreck the view from the Capitol Mall because it's lower down. Just wondering, because was there a big discussion about putting everyone in the same building? I think that's one of the things I was sort of assuming. I heard at times, no, everyone wouldn't be. At one point, I thought they said we all were going to be in there. What's the status of that? Were those discussions going on? Like little details, but I'm not sure about some of the big picture things like that.
Mr. Waslowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I'll go back to the space report from last January, and that really outlined the options that were available. We started this process on Capitol restoration. One of the first questions we had was, can you get all the senators in the Capitol building? And so we ran through that analysis, and essentially what that would require is displacement of a significant portion of the other tenants to accommodate. And that's if you're staying within the existing building footprint. The 2007 plan was expansion of offices underground to the south. the other options presented in the space report were you could do a combination. One option was all senators out of the building. And so that's the 67 out. The other is a combination of majority and minority leadership in the Capitol, along with committee chairs. And a lot of discussion was had on, you know, the notion of the Capitol building as a working building, that we have the chamber functions as well as the committees, and you know, the desire of this to continue to be a working building for people to gather to debate the issues of the day. So that, I think, was part of that process that led to, you know, again, us in conversations with leadership on you know, 23 senators in, you know, and then looking at an office building for 44 senators. At the same time, and I should say that office building accommodates 44 senators plus staff, other Senate functions, along with addressing the hearing room issue. You're hitting on, you know, certainly I think a frustration on that we've heard from the House on why isn't it all senators in one building. The building itself, you know, if you look at the existing footprint, you would have to move certain functions out of the building to be able to accommodate all 67 senators plus staff in the building. If you move mechanical up from their current location in the basement to the roof, you potentially could get all senators in. So you really have two options to look at. One would be all mechanical on the roof, which we do have the height variance for, or keeping the mechanical in the building and moving other functions out. The mechanical on the roof comes with a cost impact. If you did that option, you're adding anywhere from $3.1 to $3.5 million to the project. The other thing is, you know, we've experienced it in the lab building recently with the damage that occurred with the Ag Health lab building. That it's a different mechanical system design. That's 100% fresh air intake, so it's different than what you have in an office building. But there's risks with putting mechanical systems on roofs. It's fairly common in the industry to do that. The idea with this being a 100-year building, with the critical nature, if something like that happened in this building during the legislative session, the significant impact, the idea of putting mechanical in the basement avoids that risk. So there's it's a balancing act and trade-offs. It's lots of conversations with leadership and others on what's the right balance to strike.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chair, with the CAP board, architecture boards, height restrictions, and so on, you could get a variance for the mechanical. What about another four? I'm just curious because I had sort of assumed that one of the goals was to try and get send it all together. I understand not everybody agrees with that. But
I think we're fine.
Are there variations? I mean, I don't know if it was one floor higher or a few feet lower floors. I don't know how it all plays out, but can't picture it destroying any of the sight lines from the Capitol Mall or anywhere, but I'm just curious, is that possible?
Mr. Chair and Senator Marion, I should be very clear that the Capitol, the relationship, the height of the building to the Capitol was a key driving factor in how the building is currently designed. The variance that request is approved, there's about a 1.8-foot variance related to the roof line. Even if you add the mechanical systems on top of that, you're still below the level of the admin building. So just from a context standpoint, when we're talking about these variances, it's relative to the other buildings that are adjacent. The question also asks is, well, if you did all 67, could you add a floor and put the 67 onto the roof? The challenge, and I don't think we have a good image that shows this, with the mechanical systems, the one thing of putting them on the roof, you're able to set that back probably to the midpoint of the roof line. So it starts at the north end of the building and goes to about the midpoint. So actually from a visual standpoint, you're not going to, if you're on the Capitol building, you're not going to see that roof line. If you did offices, you essentially do the opposite. You'd push that to the south line of the design of the building, and there you would potentially have more of an impact. I would also say from a cost standpoint, that would be much more significant from a redesign than the notion of adding mechanical on the roof. It'd be a much more significant redesign effort.
Ceremony.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm just thinking that down the road some people may be wishing we had all 67 in the same building, and doing it right the first time is important. I don't know the cost factors. I'm not in the construction stuff. I understand you have to make compromises. I just feel uneasy about it because I understand the timelines and everything else. I think some of those discussions, I don't know, maybe they all happened and so on. I just don't know that it was in a good, I feel uncomfortable at the idea that we're planning to build a building where we're still going to be in two separate buildings, even though there will be a bipartisan in both buildings. I just, that's the issue I'd have. But.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, touched on the issue of the process, and I will be very honest with you that I am very frustrated with the process that this particular building has gone through. I will candidly admit I don't necessarily understand it. But my frustration is that I don't think there was ever a bill. I honestly do not believe there was ever a public hearing on this building that we are going to go through. We've had a lot of discussion here, and I've learned fairly candidly quite a bit from Senator Pappas regarding her question regarding the arts, Senator Skoy regarding design build. Senator Marty has been talking about perhaps it's a good idea to put everybody in the same building. Senator Cohn has weighed in. These are all the kinds of things that we would maybe learn if we had a public hearing on this. Now, I notice in the bill that we have got, supposedly this is going to be paid for with something called lease revenue bonds, which, again, I don't know what they are, but I am concerned about if that is what we are going to use to pay for this building, does that impact our bonding capacity for this year? And so in my mind, we've got a situation where I think the state of Minnesota owns Lot C and Lot B, but I'm not sure. And if the state of Minnesota owns Lot C and Lot B, and we're going to build these new buildings, and it feels to me like we're going to enter into a contract with ourselves, which is this lease purchase agreement, and I don't know if a lease purchase agreement has been drafted. So there's all of these questions that are percolating that are coming out because we haven't had a public hearing on that. So with those comments in mind, Mr. Chairman, I would move that this matter be referred to the Capital Investment Committee for a hearing at the call of the chair.
Well, Senator Newman, we have, if we were to do that and adopt a committee report that directed the Rules Committee to do that, we have no way for the Senate to approve action by the Capital Investment Committee and get it back here because we're not in session. So I don't know how the law says the Rules Committee has to make this approval. If we send it out of here to Capital Investment, there is no mechanism, no floor mechanism to adopt the committee report for that to happen. I just don't know mechanically how that will work. If you really want to, I guess we can have a vote on that. It's just that I don't see, we have no floor session in order to be able to move things around. All we can do as a Rules Committee are administrative functions that don't require floor action. But I'm not saying I'm not willing to take a vote on it. I just don't know mechanically how it would work.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how it would work either. Procedurally, I don't know how it would work either. All I can do is express to you my frustration in that this is the first time, at least that I am aware of, that there has been any kind of a public hearing, and I don't think the public has had an opportunity to weigh in on this at all. I don't think there's a bill. So while, you know, I appreciate your concern. Procedurally, how do we go from here? This, to me, has just been an ugly, ugly process, and I would request a vote, Mr. Chairman. Thanks.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Newman, well, this was in the Senate tax bill. It was added in committee on April 24th. That was an oral amendment, or it was an amendment with an oral vote. So this was in the bill, the Senate tax bill that was on the floor of the Senate. It was signed into law on May 23rd, so it was around for about a month. Was in the conference committee discussion, was in the conference committee report. It has had some process. It has was in the Senate bill that was on the floor last year. So, I don't think that the procedural is moving at the capital equipment. But the other thing is the last couple of buildings that have been built on the Capitol area, and I'm blanking on the names of the two, were used with a lease purchase process. So this is not new. There's precedent for the last couple buildings that were built, and maybe staff can tell me what the names of those two buildings are, but it's not new.
Mr. Waslowski, the lease purchase option?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, it's Anderson Building and Freeman Building use this mechanism, as well as the BCA Bemidji Building use this mechanism. Retirement Systems was a similar mechanism, but with a little bit different structure.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman, then Senator Hand.
I'm not questioning whether or not this mechanism, lease purchase, has been utilized before. I don't know if it's appropriate when the owner of the property and the tenant of the property are one and the same. I don't know if the lessor here is going to be a construction company or it's going to be the state of Minnesota. Those are all questions that are just rattling around in my brain, so I'm not questioning that. And you are right, Senator Scoy. This was in the tax bill. I acknowledge that. It came out of the conference committee. I acknowledge that. There was no bill on it, and there was no hearing on it. That's the point that I'm trying to make. Is it appropriate to send it back to the Capital Investment Committee? Is it going to be more difficult, and will we have to maybe have some future hearings on it? Probably, but at least we could open this up and let folks answer some of these questions. Senator Bach, I don't think you're going to allow me the time necessary to ask all the questions that I have regarding this particular project today. I think we're running out of time. I think we have to have a committee hearing on this project. And it has not happened to date. So I do request that we have a vote, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think, Sir Newman, I think you're raising a good point. Mr. Waslowski, you can correct me. I think the other projects you referred to that we did do using this mechanism were part of a bonding bill, I believe. And that does raise the question. And as long as we're talking about this process and whether we're going to move it back to another committee and have hearings and do something in a little more traditional or orderly fashion, it does raise the issue that there is a lawsuit that has been brought on this issue and questioning the fact that it was passed in the way that it was in the tax bill, without a hearing, a violation of the constitutional provisions. And there have been similar instances where the courts have found that that hasn't passed muster. And the court is taking this up next week. It would seem to me that for us to take the action that we're contemplating prior to having the court weigh in would be imprudent. And to take Senator Newman's suggestion would certainly put some delay in this to give the court an opportunity to decide whether or not this is a constitutional way of building a building, which, to my knowledge, has never been done before, despite the lease-purchased facility. As far as I know, we have never built a building that originated as an amendment to a tax bill and has put the obligation on the taxpayer ultimately. I've not been on the capital bonding committee, but typically when you obligate taxpayers, you need 41 votes. And we didn't have that. In fact, all the Republicans voted against it on the floor. We had an amendment to pull it out of the tax bill. We all voted against it to take it out. I think in the tax committees, I recall, I think the members of our caucus in the tax committee did not
agree to put it in. And so the record on this has been one of having it be not a consensus, not a bipartisan effort. But the process is unusual. It happened in an unusual way. There are questions that are being raised. There has not been the opportunity for there to be public hearing. I think Senator Newman's suggestion to try to move this to another venue, allow it to go through more orderly process, makes a lot of sense. And so I would support his motion.
On the Newman motion to re-refer this issue to the Capital Investment Committee, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no?
No.
No.
Motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator, actually, I have Senator Gazelka next.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was actually along the lines of what Senator Marty talked about. And I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but I have no idea how many senators would have liked a different plan of all of us being here. And I, for one, thought that was a good idea when we were in the majority. You know, I watched former Senator Linda Berglund try to make it from the House over here, and maybe that's the reason she retired. But we don't even know. And then secondly, related to that, is we don't even know, would that save us $50 million? Would that, you know, we don't have any idea because we haven't had any conversation. So I want to make that point as well that, you know, it's still not too late to take a look at some of those options.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got another motion that maybe I will be able to address some of your concerns regarding this committee losing jurisdiction of the, the matter. But I am aware of this lawsuit that Senator Hand just alluded to. And just very recently, I think it was last week, court intervened on the Viking Stadium and issued an injunction stopping some bond sales. And frankly, I know that, for lack of a better term, we'll call it the Knobloch lawsuit. I know that it's been filed. I have reason to believe that there's going to be a hearing on it next week. By statute, a judge has to rule on that motion within 90 days. And if we move forward and move this matter out of this committee today, and that judge issues an order enjoining the state from moving forward with this process, the building of this building, to me, we are now really perched on the horns of a dilemma, because we will have been moving forward towards the completion of this project, and now we have to stop because the court has issued a court order enjoining the state from moving forward. So to me, we are simply compounding the problem that we have, and because the court is in the Knobloch lawsuit, is scheduled a hearing, because a similar situation has happened with the Viking Stadium issue, I would move, Mr. Chairman, to table this matter to the call of the chair after the Ramsey County District Court has issued its order on the Knobloch motion, or the Knobloch lawsuit.
Senator Newman, let's assume the state prevails, and then Mr. Knobloch decides to appeal. The issue is still in front of the courts. What has changed? I don't see how delaying it will change anything if we're to wait for a couple weeks to do this.
We don't have any control over whether the plaintiff or the defendant in the Knobloch suit is going to appeal. One of them is going to lose. We don't have any control over that. But at least we would be in a position for you to call us back in to a rules committee and address the outcome of the lawsuit. There is the one thing I can guarantee you, there isn't a single person here sitting today that knows what that court is going to do with that lawsuit. We don't know what the court's reasoning is going to be. We don't know what the decision is. At least we would be able to revisit the issue and look at what the court is doing. I just don't see why we would want to put ourselves in a position of moving forward with this building, knowing full well that there is a lawsuit pending in which the plaintiff is asking to enjoin us from moving forward. It's almost like you're looking for a fight, not you. that we'd be looking for a fight.
Mr. Wasilowski.
Mr. Chair, members, one of the challenges that we have on the project is the timeline. And obviously we have the rules committees to have approval on, as well as resolution of the lawsuit. From a project standpoint, we need to be able to continue design work maintain the schedule. And that, if we don't maintain that schedule, we're going to have cost impacts both on this project and potentially on capital restoration. So one of the things just for the committee to consider when it's thinking about this issue is the direction that we're providing to the design build team. Really, it at this point, what would happen is if the Rules Committee approved it, we would be proceeding with design development, preparation of design development. If that's there's a delay in that, there's going to be impacts both from a cost impact and a schedule standpoint.
Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Wasilowski's point, the timeline deadline that admin is concerned about, I do understand. But I do not believe that that is going to be an issue that the court is going to consider in making the decision in the Knobloch suit. It's a problem for admin. I understand that. But this timeline business, insofar as the court is concerned, is not going to be part of the merits of that suit. The other question I would have regarding my motion, Mr. Chairman, is according to the legislation, the House has to act on this also, I believe. And, Mr. Chair, if we were to pass my motion, do you have any idea where the House is in terms of their committee hearing? Is it going to be a week from now, next week? Do you have any knowledge so that the two would sort of dovetail together?
Mr. Wasilowski, you've had conversations with the House. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, members, they've requested some information, some follow-up information from us. We've now provided that and just waiting to hear back on whether there's additional information that's needed or whether they're prepared to schedule the committee hearing.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wasilowski, with respect to Senator Newman's motion to table this and give it some time to get further scrutiny, if we don't do that, if we act on this, what happens next? You said you're going to proceed. I don't know exactly what that means. I'm assuming that means you're going to let the bonds. Who is the owner of the bonds? And what is that financing structure going to look like? This is apparently not a capital investment project. So who is the owner of the bonds? Who's going to let them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hand, MMB, on behalf of the state, would issue the bonds.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Mr. Wasilowski, that raises a question in my mind about if the public is owning the debt through a bonding mechanism, doesn't the Constitution require that a supermajority approve that? Isn't that the standard? We have to have 41 votes to put the public in debt. Isn't that what the Constitution says? And how do we get around that with this mechanism? Have you had advice from counsel to suggest that this is legal to do this?
Mr. Wasilowski.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hahn, obviously working with legal counsel, we're responding to the litigation, and as noted, the hearing on that is next week. From our perspective, what we did was after the law was passed, we worked to implement that law. And, been working, since that point to and using that along with the capital restoration process, that this is the direction that the legislature had provided for us to go. So that the fact that a lawsuit was filed, there was no temporary injunction against the project. It didn't say stop the work. It said there's going to be a hearing on it because the cost impacts of stopping are immediate. So that's
And Mr. Wasilowski, what are the cost implications of letting the bonds in the way that you're describing and then having the court say that's unconstitutional?
Mr.
And
Chair,
you've already let those bonds and the work has proceeded. How do you undo that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hatton, but I had the opportunity to make this point. M&B will not issue the bonds until the litigation is resolved.
And Mr. Chairman, if that's the case, then there is no urgency for us to act today until, to Senator Newman's point, the court has its opportunity to make a ruling.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hatton, the only thing I'm asking to be considered is that the direction that we're providing to the design build team, are they continuing with their design build work based on the plan that's submitted to the Rules Committee for consideration, or are we stopping their work and immediately incurring schedule and cost impacts? That's for the committee to consider, but that's the impact of the schedule and where we're at.
On the Newman motion to delay.
Roll call, please.
Oh, Senator Fishbein.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on the Newman motion when you get.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman or maybe Mr. Wasilowski. I'm trying to figure this out in terms of I'm not a lawyer. I don't know what the odds of the lawsuit are. It seems to me there's some reasonable questions being raised there, and the courts are going to rule one way or another. If they rule in favor of Mr. Knobloch, presumably the design committee and everything is going to be retooling a lot of this. I mean, everything, presumably. So I hope you're planning for that contingency as well. I feel like, you know, this is between a rock and a hard place. I'm not comfortable with some of the decisions that I think weren't necessarily made, but again, I was not involved in this 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 3 years ago. And I see some urgent need for addressing some space problems for some staff. I see when you walk in here and you see the fumes in the building right now and the safety of staff who are in the building. So I guess I don't see what postponing this 1 week later. In other words, Senator Newman, even if we vote now, they're not going to sell the bonds till after it's resolved, and the House has to act too. So I guess I think that, you know, there's acting now after we're all here and having the meeting, having the long discussion. I think we ought to deal with it today. But in the end, I hope that everybody involved recognizes that there are obstacles, including apparently the House Rules Committee. And all the discussions Senator Bach and Senator Hand had earlier about the space allocations in the Capitol, I hope those are more discussions and less arguments, though I understand everybody seems to fight for their own. But we shouldn't be seeing the House as the enemy or the governor's office or anyone as the enemy. We should be trying to work together on what makes good space allocation. And I guess I just hope I don't have problems with dealing with this today, knowing that the lawsuit is coming later. I don't feel really great about where we are, though. My problem is more that I wish we would have more. I don't know. Maybe it's all happened and so on, and I haven't been involved in these, and I like a lot of the things for accessibility, for disabilities, for the public. But I guess I feel the lawsuit is on its own matter in my mind. I think that's irrelevant to today's discussion. It's going to have a big impact one way or another on the building.
May I respond? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty. First of all, I'm doing my level best to not be antagonistic or argumentative. I'm trying to lay out some issues that I think are important. Please don't take my remarks or motions in any other way. As to the lawsuit itself, the point that I'm trying to make is that if we move forward with this project today, we approve it and send it out of here, and the court rules against the legislation that was passed, we are simply going to make matters worse. We are going to make matters worse because knowing that lawsuit is coming, we nevertheless are going forward with the we're going to be spending some money. Some people are going to be engaged. According to Mr. Wislowski, he wants to get Mortensen's people involved further into this project. And the point I'm trying to make, Senator Marty, is we're just going to make it worse. We're not going to make it better. We are creating our own conundrum that we will then later have to resolve because now we're going to be looking at an injunction.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I'm not trying to argue with you, but I'm trying to figure out, because they can't sell bonds until the court ruling. But if we move today and the ruling is next week and the House is a week after, whatever the timeline is for each of those things happening, I presume Mortensen's not going home today if we postpone it a week. On the other hand, in other words, the expenditures going up until when they sell bonds, I assume, are continuing until the lawsuit is resolved and both houses have rules committees have passed it. I don't think your thing is an issue of money until the lawsuit is resolved. Then money starts, the bonds are sold then.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Marty, I don't necessarily agree with your position. Clearly, they aren't going to sell bonds until this lawsuit is resolved at some point in the future, whenever that might be. It may all go all the way to the Supreme Court, for all we know. But I do hear Mr. Wislowski saying that they want a ruling from this committee today so that they can move forward with whatever it is that they want to do with their design-build project. And he is concerned about not being able to move forward. I cannot believe that if we tell them they have to stop because we haven't passed this out of our committee in accordance with the provision in this bill, it's got to cost some money someplace. Somebody has got to be working on this. And what I'm trying to do is temporarily stop moving forward on this building until the court has issued its ruling. And look no farther than the Viking Stadium. The court weighed in and stopped it. And I simply see us making it worse if we go forward and then we are enjoined, because Mr. Wislowski will have moved forward from whatever point he is in the building today to some point in the future. They're going to continue to go forward. And I'm trying to stop it for right now. That's all, temporarily. That's what I have in mind, Senator Marty.
Senator Newman, the problem is we're not talking about a week or two delay. What if the court takes the full 90 days to rule? And then what if there's an appeal? Mr. Wislowski is trying to keep a construction schedule that is going to be, if we don't, is going to be very disruptive to the Senate in the 2016, and the building, and the Capitol won't be done in 2000 by the 17th session. There is a construction schedule that he has to keep on track because it is linked to the capital reservations, and the court may take 90 days, and then there might be an appeal. And how long are we going to wait and disrupt the schedule and incur the tens of millions of dollars of cost overruns because our contract with the capital has a completion date on it that we're not going to meet? We're not talking about a week or two.
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. We are not talking about a week or two. And the best I can tell you is that by law, the court has got 90 days in which to rule from the date of the hearing. However, I rather suspect the court is, aware of the urgency here and may rule earlier. I don't know. But I think, at least for me, folks are missing the point. This is a real lawsuit. There is a real court hearing. There's a real judge going to weigh in on this. And there's going to be real consequences to this committee and to the Senate and to the Minnesota legislature if we decide to proceed forward. Maybe it's 90 days. Maybe there's an appeal to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. The farther this thing goes down the line and the deeper we're in and ultimately lose the issue, now what are we going to do? Then it's going to take the Senate Majority Leader to figure out a way out of that problem. I'm just urging, take a little bit of time. Let's see what the court does next week. Let's come back after the court issues its ruling. Maybe that will give us some indication in what direction to go. That's all I'm asking for, Mr. Chairman.
On the Newman motion, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bach.
No.
Senator Cohen. Senator Fischbach.
Yes.
Senator Gazelka.
Yes.
Senator Han.
Yes.
Senator Limmer. Yes. Senator Marty.
No.
Senator Metzen.
No.
Senator Newman.
Yes.
Senator Pappas.
No.
Senator Sieben.
No.
Senator Skoy.
No.
Senator Stumpf.
On a vote of 7 no and 5 yes, the motion does not prevail. Senator Fischbach, then Senator Han.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question for Mr. Wasloski about it wasn't directly to the issue of the motion that Senator Newman made, but it was something that Senator Han had mentioned. And on the lease purchase, you had said earlier in the meeting that there was several buildings, Freeman and Anderson, that were paid for that way. Can you just tell me in what bills were those two buildings contained? And those bonds, I mean, I'm assuming that the bonds were let for those buildings. Were they contained in the bonding bill? I guess I'm trying to decide what if the process, as Senator Han had kind of alluded to, is that process the same? I mean, he had mentioned, you know, letting bonds, so what bills were those contained in, and how many votes? I mean, did they get the supermajority needed for bonding?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I'm aware of Anderson and Freeman building. I'm not sure on the BCA Bemidji building. Anderson Freeman, my understanding is they went through the capital investment committees, and I'm not sure the overall votes on those particular bills. There was also a similar approval process. It wasn't a rules committee. I think there was a joint legislative committee as similar to the rules committees that was put in place to review those plans as well. So it's similar in that sense from a review standpoint of the projects.
So Mr. Chair, the lease purchase system, I guess, for lack of, did require bonding and did go on those other buildings. And we, you know, the PCA, I'm just thinking Freeman and Anderson, since those two are the ones we can think of, did require the bonding numbers, or they were in the bonding bill, said.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Fischbach, I'd be careful about the word required. That's the path they went, so I'm not sure if there was other mechanisms that it could have went, that's the path that went for those bills.
Senator Han.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I guess kind of to that point and part of the question that I was asking, and I have not been a part of the Capital Investment Committee, and I don't know all the provisions, but my understanding has been that there is a constitutional requirement for the public to incur debt, and that is a supermajority, if you will, 41 votes in the Senate. And it seems to me that in every other case where we have incurred public debt, that's what we've done. We've required that, and I think for good reason. It does require that there to be a broader consensus. It does typically, not in every case I understand, but typically involve members of both parties to agree and to come to an agreement about these projects. None of that was done in this case. And it raises a question in my mind is, why don't we do all of our capital spending this way? If we can do this, why do we have a bonding bill? Why don't we just do this sort of structure for everything we do? And it would be a lot easier. Then the majority wouldn't require minority votes on these things. We just do them.
I don't get the distinction between this project, the Anderson building that was done the other way, or any other capital project that is done as part of a bonding bill that requires this higher threshold of commitment to incur public debt. This is an exception. I don't understand why it is different. And if it isn't different, then, again, that speaks, I think, in favor of us not proceeding with this, because I guess I would say that if we do this and set the precedent of spending money this way, why would we ever have a bonding bill in the future?
Well, Senator Hahn, about $700 million of appropriation bonds, tobacco bonds, that was done in 2011 as part of the budget resolution, we committed the state to $700 million of bonds. That did not have a three-fifths majority vote, and your caucus was in charge and orchestrated that mechanism to balance the budget.
The industry, they don't want it.
And, Mr. Chairman, that may be true. I think the governor agreed to that. I think there was bipartisan agreement to that mechanism. I don't think that is a capital project, as I understand it, but I'm just looking at what the capital bonding requirements are, and what I'm getting at is I don't see the distinction between this project and any other capital project by which we have always said you need to have 41 votes. And if this one is different in character or in some material way that suggests it doesn't need that 41 votes,
that's what I'm asking.
What is that difference? Because if you don't have that difference, then I would say that any other capital request could just as easily be done in this method, and are we opening the door to allow that to go forward? I don't see why not.
Well, Senator Hahn, the Supreme Court did rule on the tobacco bond issue, and the state did incur debt. The Constitution does not say capital buildings. It says for the state to incur debt. And so I don't think it's quite accurate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what you're saying is that we can go ahead and pass a bonding bill without 41 votes if we want to. That's what I guess I'm hearing you say, is that this thing that we've been working under, that you need to have 41 votes to do a bonding bill, I guess what we're hearing today is that's not true, that all takes is a simple majority, and we can use this mechanism or some other mechanism, and that's all. I that's news to me.
Other discussion? If not, the council, the motion is?
To approve the, Mr. Chairman, I think the proper motion would be to approve the preliminary program plan, or the program plan and cost estimates as submitted by the Department of Administration.
That would be the SCOI motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Country, no?
No. No.
Motion prevails. Members, thank you for your patience today. Smitty is adjourned.
We are adjourned. The what?